You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, Russian troops are captured in eastern Ukraine as Vladimir Putin and Petro Poroshenko meet face to face.
As soon as they see that they've lost their supporter and that no one is supplying them with weapons and they've run out of ammunition, there'll be peace immediately.
James Schneider and John Everard will tell us if they think there's any hope for these talks. Plus, as IS militants continue their stranglehold across the Middle East, we'll hear whether the US is preparing airstrikes in Syria. Plus, we'll ask why the UAE and Egypt struck militants in Libya. And
how much Alistair, money you spend there?
How much, blaming other people?
Do your colleagues estimate that it will cost to replace the Trident nuclear system in 2020? How much in monetary terms?
We ask whether televised political debates make any difference on voting day. All that, plus we'll check in with our woman in Vancouver and review the week in music. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, right now. But before any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines.
Palestinian and Egyptian officials have just announced that a long-term ceasefire has been agreed between Israel and Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip. Egyptian state media reported the truce, which ends 7 weeks of fighting that has left more than 2,200 people dead. The truce started an hour ago at 1600 GMT. Hamas deputy political leader Musa Abu Mazouk said the deal represented a victory for the resistance. There has been so far no comment from the Israeli government. Nigeria's health minister said on Tuesday that authorities have thus far contained the Ebola outbreak that started last month, with only one out of 13 confirmed cases still being treated in isolation in the commercial capital Lagos. The Ebola virus has already killed at least 1,427 people since March in the deadliest outbreak the world has seen. The United Nations Ebola Response Coordinator, David Naboro, says Ebola demands a complicated response requiring many organisations to work closely together.
We all need to do better to organise that response so that it achieves the result quickly without causing more suffering, death and damage. So our focus is on organisation, management, ensuring that all the different efforts of government, of partners, United Nations, is used as efficiently as it possibly can.
Staying in Africa, and the UN says one of its cargo helicopters has crashed in South Sudan, with unconfirmed reports saying it was shot down. Three crew died while one survived, said the UN mission in South Sudan, adding that an inquiry was underway. Russia's President Vladimir Putin and Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko have greeted each other with a handshake at the start of talks in Belarus today on the Ukraine crisis, the first time the two presidents have met since June. Tensions between the two countries were heightened before the meeting when Ukraine released video of Russian soldiers it has captured in eastern Ukraine, where its army has been fighting pro-Russian separatist rebels since April. Poroshenko said he had not yet had a one-to-one meeting with Vladimir Putin. The US State Department has made clear that no ransom was paid by the United States for the freed American journalist Peter Theo Curtis. He had been held by the Nusra Front, the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, and was released on the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights on Sunday. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki said Curtis was released on humanitarian grounds.
We don't make concessions to terrorist organizations, including paying ransom. We also don't support any third party paying ransom and did not do so in this case. We're unequivocal in our opposition to paying ransom to terrorists.
And finally, an 8-year-old Cuban boy who likes to dress up as Fidel Castro got to meet his idol after Cuba's 88-year-old retired leader invited him and his family to his Havana home for a chat. The boy likes to dress up in green fatigues, army boots and cap. As Castro once did, he wore the costume to his meeting with Castro, but without Castro's trademark beard and cigar. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're right back after this.
Vanuit Londen,
Dit is Monocle 24. 런던으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monocle 24.
Od London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House. And the time here in London is 18.05. That means it's 13.05 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, and John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea. Welcome both to the programme. We begin the show with an important face-to-face that's been happening between the Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko. The two men are meeting in Minsk under the auspices of the Eurasian Customs Union. Let's hear the thoughts of one Ukrainian commander.
As soon as they see that they've lost their supporter and that no one is supplying them with weapons and they've run out of ammunition, there'll be peace immediately.
Well, expectations are extremely low for these talks, and they came as news broke today that 10 Russian soldiers were captured on Ukrainian territory. Their explanation? Well, it was a bit of an accident. They'd got lost. Let's start with you, John. When you look at these unfolding talks, do you feel they serve any purpose or have any hope of achieving anything? At the weekend, Angela Merkel said that she had no hopes for them really at all.
Yes, a great build-up there by Angela. Thanks very much. Do they serve a purpose? Yes, they do. Simply bringing the two people together, the two men together into a room and getting them to eyeball each other and talk, at least gets the two of them to understand each other's position a bit better. But that's a long way from saying that these talks are going to make any progress towards peace. I think the two positions are far too far apart for that.
James, do you think it changes the agenda at all, or the narrative at all, at least, the capturing of these Russian soldiers?
I mean, only as it provides kind of further evidence of something which everybody on the Kiev government side and their Western supporters already completely knew and believed, and it's just more fact. And it's not the first bit of evidence either that we've had of Russian soldiers knocking about in the east of Ukraine. So I don't think it fundamentally changes the narrative. It's a bit embarrassing for Vladimir Putin. It doesn't look very good, but I don't think it massively alters things.
John?
Yes, further, I agree entirely with James. A further thought. Firstly, these weren't just ordinary soldiers. These were paratroopers. These are supposed to be semi-elite soldiers, people who know what they're doing. And it's rather sad that Putin thinks they might just get lost. Did their satnav break down or something? The other point is that we now have on television, because of course the Ukrainians have broadcast the interrogations, Russian POWs effectively in Ukraine. This is going to cause a slight shudder, not just in the Russian military, though there too, but I think amongst any other Russians who watch television. This is really bad news for Putin.
James, what was interesting, during those interrogations, the soldiers make it clear that they were kind of stripped of their kind of ID. They were kind of sent across the border. They weren't exactly sure what their mission was early on. They seem to speak with the same kind of thoughts. It doesn't sound as though they've been coached or anything. So for the Russians, I know we live in this kind of dual reality world when it comes to Russia, that both sides won't believe anything the other says. But do you think there's any chink? As we're just saying here that for Russians even, it must begin to look likely that they are sending their troops across the border.
Yes, it does. I mean, it's difficult to. So there's one of the troops who said that we're being sent here as cannon fodder, I think is the quote, which we don't know whether that's what the Ukrainians have tried to make him say, whether he's been sent to go and say that, or that's what he really thinks. It looks like that's what he really thinks. And that does sort of suggest a lack of sort of discipline and organisation on the Russian side, organising this. But at some point it was going to come out. It's quite difficult to run a kind of involved proxy war, not even proxy war, where you have some of your people inside in the other territory either doing training or logistical support or things like that without it emerging at some point. So I don't think that I mean, I would be very surprised if Putin and co. were sitting there planning all of this beforehand, thinking this will never come out. They'll never know that we were there, because it had to become obvious at some point.
I'm not sure exactly what time the troops will catch up, but at the weekend we had Lavrov saying, oh, what's going to happen is, you know, that the West are going to say that, you know, we've sent troops. This is when the story came out about, you know, the tanks being sent across the border. No doubt the press in the West will be saying we've been sending troops into Russia. But I don't know if they already knew that it was quite likely that some of their people were going to get caught. But it does seem that they don't really care, because they just stick this line that, oh, it was a mistake, it was an accident, it's the West to blame, it's the media coverage. There is a kind of like twin reality going on, isn't there?
There is a twin reality going on, but I don't think that means they don't care. I think they do, and I think they've been profoundly embarrassed by this. Of course, things are made a lot worse by the fact that this capture took place just as Putin sat down with Poroshenko in Minsk, you know, embarrassing the president personally. I think that they really did think they could get away with this, that they could dress up Russians to look like pro-Russian separatists and that nobody would spot the difference. It sounds crazy, but I think they have entered a kind of parallel universe in which these things seem possible.
For both of you, but starting with you, James, I wonder whether the problem here is also that, you know, we know some of the bigger ambitions maybe of Putin is in the sense that, you know, yes, he would like the situation to remain a bit disturbed. He kind of wants to give Ukraine a hard time. He wants to give the West a hard time. But when it comes down to any negotiations, it's quite hard to know exactly what he would want out of any kind of deal. Does he want, you know, the breaking up of Ukraine? Does he want, you know, the cantonization of Ukraine? It doesn't really seem clear what they would be negotiating exactly for.
I don't think he has to decide right now what his absolute desired long-term vision for what Ukraine will be, because there are many options open. But he has already secured what his short to medium-term objective is, which is to sufficiently destabilize Ukraine territorially that it can never become part of NATO. It's the same thing that was done with Georgia. Georgia can't become part of NATO because it has unresolved border disputes now. Ukraine will have the same thing. So in the kind of, you know, short to medium term, preventing Ukraine from fully exiting its orbit entirely and becoming even more antagonistic than it currently is, has been achieved, and that's what he'll hold on to.
Yeah, I think the crazy thing is that he actually achieved that objective with the annexation of Crimea. Mm. He didn't need to go wading into eastern Ukraine in pursuit of it, and I think the whole eastern Ukraine venture is becoming a real nightmare for Putin.
Quickly before we move on, the other thing that strikes me is, we've had the downing of the Malaysian Airlines flight. We've had, as you say, the taking of Crimea. But those things almost seem to be forgotten now, that, you know, that the agenda moves so kind of like from week to week. Yeah, it's incredible that, you know, there is almost no political pressure on Putin because of the Malaysia Airlines flight anymore.
I don't think that's quite true. I think that what we're watching is a steady ratcheting of pressure. And I think that the Malaysian Airlines debacle will have damaged Putin really quite badly. Probably to an extent domestically, not all Russians are going to believe the story that it was shot down by Ukrainian fighters that, it turns out, can't achieve that altitude anyway. But certainly internationally. I mean, we have to remember that there are some countries who are going to want to believe the Russian narrative, whatever it is, and others who are going to believe the Western narrative. But there's a whole group in the middle to play for. And they, I think, as a group, were really shocked and horrified by what was quite clearly a Russian missile hitting an undefended airliner.
Well, let's leave Ukraine now and shift our focus to the continuing crisis in Syria as IS militants continue to capture swathes of territory. In a possible first step towards airstrikes, President Obama has authorised reconnaissance flights over Syria to gain more information over IS and what possible equipment and troops they may have on the ground. James, you know, do you think this will pave the way for airstrikes?
I hope not. I don't think airstrike, I mean, on the purely how to tackle the Islamic State front, they're not going to be removed just with airstrikes. And what are airstrikes going to do? Are they going to flatten Raqqa? Are they going to go and, you know, it's not as if they can go and see, the Islamic State doesn't have, for example, an air force, which is just suddenly, you know, out on display, which they can go and bomb and remove. It doesn't have its forces always out on display who can be removed. And the difference between action in Syria and action in Iraq is there are at least partners that the US can work with who can be ground troops in Iraq, to some extent the Iraqi military and to much more extent the Kurdish Peshmerga. But in Syria, there isn't that. And so, I mean, the possibility of airstrikes, I think, from a military perspective is absurd. And then, I mean, there are other reasons why just having airstrikes would be...
But you think absurd because it's dangerous, or absurd because
it won't
it's
work.
Pointless?
It won't work. If your aim is to remove ISIS and to defeat ISIS, it won't do so. It may have lots of other bad knock-on effects as well, but the key point is it won't have the desired effect. You can't just beat a military opponent like this just from the air. There needs to be some kind of ground involvement, and America can't do that right now and doesn't have anybody who can do it on their behalf.
John, it certainly hasn't worked in Afghanistan. We still have the same problems there year after year. Do you think that this is a pointless endeavour if they do start attacking ISIS?
I agree with James. I'm not at all sure that that is their plan. I think that a lot of commentators have taken a kind of leap into the dark, saying that reconnaissance flights have to be in some way a prelude to airstrikes. They may not be. It may be that, for example, the US is simply making a gesture. I mean, having large American aircraft whizzing around overhead is a little bit scary if you're a probably semi-literate IS militant down below. The other thing they might be able to do with this is to feed the reconnaissance data to the Free Syrian Army. Now, I don't think that the Free Syrian Army at present is in a position to launch a major offensive against IS, but at least having data on where the IS forces are would help them to build their defensive positions. And over time, I don't know what American plans are for arming the Free Syrian Army, but over time, it may be that they are the ally in the region which the US actually lacks in the moment.
James, an enemy we weren't even talking about a year ago, and now it's become this undefeatable beast.
Yes, well, I mean, it's not undefeatable, I think, because it's so kind of inherently brilliant in and of itself and its fighting capacity and all the rest of it. It's the situation in which it finds itself and the people, the entities it is up against. There is no real agent that can fully take it on. And the alliance of the different otherwise competing forces, the different Gulf states, the US, Russia, the Assad regime, the plethora of militias that are fighting in Syria, Iran, and so on and so on and so on, can't be all brought together.
And John, when you look at what's unfolding here, do you feel the same? How is it that we have been so wrong-footed? Here is an organisation we knew so little about. It hadn't swept certainly into the public's mind, and now it's kind of dominating our headlines every day, and we do seem rather ill-equipped to know what to do.
Yes, I think it's caused a certain amount of head-scratching in a lot of capitals, including, let it be said, in Damascus. I mean, we berate ourselves for not having seen this coming. I think it's fairly clear, despite his recent pronouncements to the contrary, that Assad had no real idea of the viper he was nurturing in his own bosom. I think that historians will have a very interesting time unravelling just how IS came to be and how it came to be so powerful so quickly and how it became so lethal.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, James Schneider and John Everard. When we return, we'll look at why the United Arab Emirates and Egypt conducted their own set of airstrikes in North Africa. And we'll also hear whether the political debate really matters anymore. Stay tuned.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, and John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, among other places. Now, before the break, we were discussing whether the US is preparing possible airstrikes against IS targets in Syria. But now we're moving to North Africa. US officials have reportedly said they were kept completely out of the loop over airstrikes by Emirati fighter jets based in Egypt. They targeted Islamist militants near Tripoli's main international airport sometime last week in a bid to stop militias from gaining control of the capital, a move which ultimately failed. James, is Libya therefore effectively lost, do you think?
Lost to who?
Well, lost in the sense that, you know, the agenda that we had for the West was, you know, the installation of some form of government that could hopefully nudge its way towards democracy, that could be inclusive, that could be a kind of a new barrier on the North African coast between, you know, other rival groups and things. But what we're seeing is, again, the fracturing of all sorts of, you know, tribal leadership. We're left with a situation that certainly the West feels, you know, it has very little hand it can play. It's pulled its, you know, its embassy staff out. It's very light on the ground now. It's hoping that other players could do something, but it doesn't seem likely, does it?
No, but I think any analysis should start by really challenging the idea that was in any way possible or outcome for Libya coming out of the uprising, the civil war, and the sort of NATO involvement in it. The idea, if that was the case in Western capitals, that somehow you can fly back in a few regime critics who don't have too much control over different militias fighting on the ground, and somehow that's going to coalesce into some wonderful liberal force which will act as a beacon or a bulwark or whatever the, you know, IR terms that get bandied about are, is nonsense. That was never going to be the case. I mean, Libya is in an appalling situation. It is one that is getting worse, but it's not as if it was ever in a position where it was about to be this, you know, bright shining hope. And the, you know, where Western countries, you know, should share some of the blame or aren't quite pulling their weight or aren't quite telling the truth is, if you are even in a relative to, you know, other regime change exercises, lightly involved in some kind of military process, and then you have big shiny photo ops with your favoured supposed leaders of the revolution when you overthrow Gaddafi, and you get political capital out of that, then you then have responsibilities, and those have been rejected entirely. And also, there's been a large amount of acting dumb, as if what's going on in Libya doesn't really, they don't really know what's going on. I mean, the US line, I think, about, oh, we're very surprised that there's been this attack, is, I mean, either US and NATO are unbelievably incompetent. I mean, incompetent to the extreme at which they would be in breach of a UN Security Council resolution. Or they, of course, they did know, because they're monitoring the airspace, because they are meant to be monitoring the airspace. So they would have seen any build-up of flights, and they would have seen who was doing it. So we've got a situation where everyone's trying to look away from Libya as much as they can as soon as the revolution ended and attention has moved elsewhere, and now it's being forced back. And frankly, I don't see from any of the Western foreign policy leaders any sort of sign that they really know what's going on. They've just sort of looked away, hope it would go away, and it hasn't. And now they've got a situation which is, I mean, it's just very, very, very messy.
John, when the Libyan revolution happened, it was very hard, it seemed, for the Western powers to prod the Emirati Air Force into any action. I think they famously flew one sortie. But now suddenly they're in action at a time when it's claimed the Western forces or the Western governments hadn't been kind of pushing them that hard at all. What do you think is going on with the Emiratis?
I think that the Emiratis have finally decided that the time when they had to consult the United States every time they took an international action has passed. And I think they are simply flagging up that from here on they, and also the Egyptians, are going to act on their own. I think that the surprise in the West is not so much that the airstrikes took place, it's that they took place without any kind of consultation. I think Washington had expected that they would at least be talked to before the Emiratis actually went in, and that clearly hasn't happened.
Well, before we end the show, we're going to discuss last night's debate over the future of Scotland. Alex Salmond, leader of the Yes campaign for independence, battled it out with Alistair Darling, leader of the No camp. Let's hear a tiny bit of the debate.
Oh, this is talking games. About people's jobs,
this
people's
is not
lives.
Games.
It's an important
this
issue.
Is the National
it,
Health
it is
Service.
For you to decide how much money
Alistair?
You spend there.
How
don't
much,
go blaming
Alistair?
Other people.
Do your colleagues estimate that it will cost to replace the Trident nuclear system in 2020? How much in monetary terms?
Look, I don't think you choose either between defending the country and spending money on the health service.
How much?
The cost is over a 40-year period, something like £80 billion.
Right, so £4 billion a year.
But I don't believe...
Do you think that's a sensible use of money?
That you choose between defending your country and spending money on the health service.
If we're independent,
listen,
Alistair.
Don't you lecture me on that.
Well, I'm
in
telling
the 13
you,
years
you
I was in government, I was part of a government that made sure we did spend more money on the health service.
Well, I think someone described it as a bit of like a fight outside a kebab shop minus the kebab. John?
Yes, there's a point there that I'm just gasping to get out. What is 80 divided by 40? Yes. The man can't even do sums. I mean, and they're going to make him first minister? Ah.
But do on the bigger, you know, apparently 70% of people watching that or who commented afterwards felt that Alex Salmond had won the day. Last time, obviously, it was widely thought he hadn't won the day. But the level of debate, it's such a brawl. As you say, it's quite hard to imagine that it's very enlightening for people watching or that it kind of encourages people to go out to vote. Do you think it will move ultimately people's sentiment about whether they believe in independence or not?
No, I don't. Firstly, it was shouty, I think, is the official media word. There was almost no moderation. They were simply screaming across each other. The level of debate reminded me of the kind of debates you got into in the third form at school where you used to throw ink blots at each other. I mean, it was of that order. Really not a fine example of democracy in action. Would it swing the outcome? Most unlikely. Not just because of the low quality of the debate, but also because one thing the opinion polls are showing very clearly is that there aren't that many don't knows left. We're down below the 10% mark. Most people have already made up their minds which way they're going to vote on 18th September. I suppose that the debate might have swung a few yeses into the no camp and vice versa, but really very few. Essentially, there's not a lot left out there to play for, and I think the thing will now churn towards a predictable conclusion.
James, do you think the debate was important? Do you think it will have moved people?
And I think the debate is important, and I mean in as much as it's been part of a kind of much broader debate, which is not just between these two particular men or even these two particular formalised camps, but it does appear to have been a really large debate within Scottish society, which is evidenced by the percentage of people who say they're absolutely certain to vote, which is pushing 80%. So we're going to have a massive turnout. It's clearly been a really vibrant and vigorous debate. I don't necessarily mean what was on television last night, but the whole process. And I think that's been very healthy. And we should be more trying to look at that rather than did the hour and a half that was on BBC Scotland. But then, addressing that point, did it change very much? If you look at the betting markets, before the vote, it was about 13.5% chance for a yes. Before the debate, at the end of it, it went up to about 16%, and then about an hour afterwards, it dropped down to about 14%. So people are putting money on it. Don't think it changed that much.
John, the debate has been quite exciting. The notions of what a country stands for, even the Trident discussion is interesting. But the shame is when it comes down to these two men, it's very alienating. And I know that they have trouble motivating a large number of female voters, especially the yes vote. It's felt that they haven't quite engaged with women. And I wonder if that partly is because Alex Salmond is, he's a brawler. He's just, he gets his points across by thumping them home.
Well, that's right. And Alistair Darling isn't so much of a brawler, but neither is he any kind of charismatic figure. And the debate, had they sort of paused from their shouting at each other for a while, I think would have been pretty flat. Yes, the two personalities involved are frankly not inspiring, and they don't really do justice to some of the really interesting themes that, as James said, are coming out of this debate.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. But James Schneider and John Everard, thank you very much for joining us, as usual, on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist ja Tokiost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to be checking in with our woman in Vancouver to hear about the city's Prince of Pot, and we'll also review the week in music. But before we get started on that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the World News headlines.
Thank you very much. Palestinian and Egyptian officials have just announced that a long-term ceasefire has been agreed between Israel and Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip. Egyptian state media reported the truce, which ends 7 weeks of fighting and has left already 2,200 people dead. Nigeria's health minister said on Tuesday that authorities had thus far contained the Ebola outbreak that started last month, with only one out of 13 confirmed cases still being treated in isolation in the commercial capital Lagos. The Ebola virus has already killed at least 1,427 people since March in the deadliest outbreak the world has seen. Staying in Africa, and the UN says one of its cargo helicopters has crashed in South Sudan, with unconfirmed reports saying it was shot down. Three crew died, while one survived. And Russia's President Vladimir Putin and Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko have greeted each other with a handshake at the start of talks in Belarus today on the Ukraine crisis, the first time the two presidents have met since June. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. Jonathan will, of course, be back in 30 minutes with a fuller roundup of the world news headlines. But welcome back to Midori House, which is live here on Monocle 24. And the time now is 18.31, which means it's 21.31 in Moscow and 14.31 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today, well, we're heading to Vancouver. And joining me on the line is our woman there, Lucy Hislop. Lucy, thanks very much for coming on the show. Let's dive straight in with this story about the Prince of Pot, Mark Emery, who's back after 5 years in jail. Tell us what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. There was quite a big outcry at the time when he got jailed for 5 years down in the States. He had been selling pot seeds from Canada to the States. And, so there's huge coverage of his return. A lot has changed. The world has turned a lot since he's been away. West Coast has obviously long been full of the BC bud. The 420 culture here is huge. 420 obviously being the time that you light up, and April 20th being a very important date here. And he, he is going to come back, and he's going to be an advocate. He's going to continue to be an advocate of policy reform. And I think that, because we have the election next year in Canada, it's a kind of one of those revved up issues, those real wedges between the Conservatives and the Liberals. The Conservatives are saying that Liberals who want to make the weed more accessible to children by having it displayed in neighborhood stores. And of course, the Liberals are denying this, saying it's better to have a legalized culture. And of course, it is legal in parts of the state. So, I think it must be quite extraordinary for Emery, who's returned, just to see how the world has changed. And, maybe perhaps he wouldn't have been jailed for that length of time had it been, 5 years forward. So, yeah, it's a really interesting time. And I think he's already said that he's up to 15 or 20 joints a day now. So,
can I just say, was he welcomed back as a bit of a rogue hero?
Absolutely. I don't think even rogue. I think he's the Prince of Pot. That may be self-styled, but it's definitely how he's regarded. Certainly on the West Coast, I think that should be made quite a distinction, really, between the West and the East. He's been very, very much welcomed back on the steps of the Vancouver Art Gallery as a sort of a kind of meeting place, and that's definitely where he's been greeted. He'll go on and carry on with his kind of policy reform for sure.
Well, if he wasn't having 50 to 20 of them a day, I'd imagine he'd be able to make much more of it and have a bit more fun. But anyway, the sockeye, which is obviously a fish, what's this about them having heart attacks?
Well, it's quite an interesting story in that in Canada, this is the time when there are always a lot of stories about salmon. My neighbor came around the other day and said that she had a friend out on a boat and had tons of salmon. Would we like one? You know, it's a kind of really kind of a big cultural moment when the salmon are coming in, they're going upstream to spawn. And it's turned out that the University of British Columbia has worked out that there are some salmon who do this something called a burst swim, and it means that they require a sort of extra energy and oxygen to get them, and you know, creates this buildup of lactic acid that takes them upstream, and so they're kind of going the fastest part of the stream, and they're struggling and getting all up there, and that apparently en route to their spawning grounds they're more likely to have a heart attack. It's a question mark at the moment, but it's something that is intriguing researchers out here. So,
but do they know what the trigger is? Is it just literally so much effort diving up those waterfalls that they conk out?
That's exactly it. It's basically that there's this build-up in lactic acid in the blood, and that may lead to a cardiac collapse or a heart attack. So, you know, it's sort of basically they're saying that those ones who take a more leisurely approach up the stream might end up with obviously being able to spawn. I mean, they die anyway at that point.
And they certainly die if they're trapped by your neighbour and offered you for supper anyway.
So, there you go.
Before we go into the last story you've tagged us, I just wanted to ask another question, which is, we saw yesterday the sale of Tim Horton, the Canada's coffee chain, to Burger King. How's that going down with people in Canada?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's still in talks at the moment, but if you poll people in the lineup, in the queue, wanting their Timmies, they basically say that, you know, as long as it doesn't change the coffee culture, and it really is, especially on the East Coast, it's really, you know, their coffee they absolutely adore. That's the coffee they go for. So they don't want any influence of Burger King. But I understand that actually one of the kind of key points about it is that if Burger King sets up its headquarters up here, where in Canada, the corporation tax is cheaper than down south. So that's kind of one of the things. So how it's going down is, as long as it doesn't affect how their coffee will taste in the morning, it's okay.
As long as Timmy's is still there. Now, finally, a story which seemed a bit daft, but it just kind of caught the world's imagination. This was this was Hitchbot, and the hitchhiking robot has now completed his journey.
Yeah, as you say, it does sound a slightly kind of daft thing, but he's journeyed 6,000 kilometres across Canada and has arrived at its destination. And it basically is a little robot that looks sort of straight out of Toy Story, and it's been left on the side of the road, and it's basically saying, you know, take me to your, you know, take me across Canada as far as you're going. So it's hitching a ride. It's been done in order to have a professor at McMaster University is wanting to kind of see, you know, human-robot interaction. It does have a bit of artificial intelligence and does talk back to you. And it's also to sort of see whether that, you know, robots can trust human beings. So it's quite interesting. You know, it hasn't been graffitied or trashed. It has actually arrived here, you know, and it's lapped up a wedding, and it's hiked a mountain, caught a ferry ride, had a lovely First Nations welcome, and also done the Harlem Shake. So, you know, it's had a bit of a good time and a good journey. And yes, it's a great way to get 35,000 Twitter followers within only a few weeks. So, yeah, it's made for an interesting attention grabber.
Do we know whether he had a Timmy on the way?
Yeah, very good. I'm not entirely sure, but I bet Timmy must have been involved.
Lucy, great to speak to you. That's Lucy Hislop, who's a woman in Vancouver, which is obviously in Canada. Thank you very much for joining us. Up next, we're going to speak to the Brazilian author Paulo Scott about his new book, Nowhere People. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
Monocle Magazine is an essential monthly briefing of affairs, business, culture, design and travel. For £90 sterling, we'll deliver the whole year round to your home, regardless of where that might be. That's 10 issues, plus our summer and winter newspapers, Mediterraneo and Alpino. and our exclusive Monocle tote bag designed by our creative team. Plus, all annual subscriptions allow you access to our extensive online archive. So subscribe today for a year of essential briefings. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. The time here is 18:39. Paulo Scott is an award-winning author in his native Brazil, having published three novels, a book of short stories, and four volumes of poetry. His most well-known book, Still Orangutans, was even made into a feature film. Now Paulo is out with his newest book, Nowhere People. The book straddles themes including the country's political and social developments from places including Sao Paulo, the country's indigenous Guarani Indians, to even immigrants' struggles in London. Well, joining me now in the studio, I'm very pleased to say, is Paulo Scott. Welcome to the programme. Paulo, just tell me, first of all, nice for you to see your work translated into English and you begin to find a bigger audience beyond Brazil.
Yeah, it's very important. If you write in Portuguese, you know, you can't reach, you know, the audience that decide, you know, what is important, you know, because all centers, I mean magazines and newspapers that define what is important or not important, you know, is still in English. So I think it's an important thing to any Brazilian author, and I'm very happy because I think this is a subject that is important not only for Brazilians but for everyone. Even when you say that indigenous subject is, few people know about that.
Yes, because I was going to say that, you know, it's fascinating when you go to Brazil.
Yeah,
it's such a huge country that often when you speak to people in Sao Paulo and you ask, for example, where have you traveled? And you say, have you ever been to, you know, Bahia or to Brasilia? They've not been. They've been to Miami, but they haven't been in their own country. And yeah, so even the topics you're talking about for Brazil, I presume that some people in Brazil don't know that much about the Guarani people or about tribal people. Could you tell us how important, again, that was for you to, for even for the audience in Brazil, to explain something of these people's stories and challenges in the book?
The point is, the indigenous people are invisible, you know, to the rest of Brazilians. We don't know much about them, you know. This is a very strange situation, and even if you ask to someone if travel to North Brazil, to Amazon, most of Brazilians doesn't know nothing about the North Brazil, you know, and that's the first time in all history of Brazilian literature that indigenous girl receive a voice, you know, a strong voice that show how could be hard, you know, stay outside, outside the civilization or outside the life, you know. The suicides were really high with the indigenous teenagers. That was one of the important points that inspired me to write this novel.
Now, the novel is, the protagonist is called Paulo, who's a law graduate from Rio, a Trotskyite and a member of the party, and he's interning a law firm. Yeah. And he meets this Brazilian girl, Mina, on a drive home, who is who's from the tribe.
Yeah.
Now, tell me, there's a few coincidences here with your own personal history, a name included. Is this story a little bit your story as well?
Yeah, listen, I'm talking a lot about my generation, yeah, because we were in redemocratization time, And we said that we couldn't do the same mistakes that the guys that came before us did, and we were deadly sure about that. But now my generation is in the power, judges, government guys, businessmen, and I see that. Brazil is still a very critical place, you know, and
so even though we see, obviously we see the World Cup, we see the Olympics coming up, we see a very modern image of, a democratic Brazil. But for you, there are still political issues that, the history from the military era, all these things are still being played out in some ways in modern Brazil.
Yeah.
And so you wanted to tell a political story as well as, the story of these tribal people.
Yeah, political issues are not very frequently nor common in Brazilian literature, but it's changing. You know, when I wrote this book, my publisher said, "Oh, come on, Paulo, you don't need a book about Indians because nobody wants to read, a book about Indians." But it changed a lot, because I started writing this book in 2006. Okay, but the things changed a lot, and we have a lot of problems, new problems that probably the democracy is allowed us to show and discuss. In the World Cup, the things got really critical. And
well, brilliant. Thank you very much for coming. That's Paulo Scott. The book is called Nowhere People. It's been translated by Daniel Hahn, and it's out now and other stories. And we'd highly recommend it. As we say, it's a story about contemporary Brazil, but also what happened in Brazil since the 80s, really. It's politics, it's more, and it's a great, great narrative. Thank you very much for coming in and joining us. Well, it's time for a bit of music now. And we just heard, of course, from the Brazilian author Paulo Scott. So to stick with a slightly Latin American vibe, here is Mohandas with Saudade do Pará.
Lá no Guamá eu fui te encontrar, andei toda Belém, mas não vi ninguém.
Vem, meu amor, vem.
Eu tô bem sozinho, mas contigo é tão melhor.
Eu já
te procurei no forró.
Foi lá.
Na cintura tu me deu um nó. Dançando carimbó foi que provei o sol.
Well, that was Saudade do Pará by Mohandas. And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're going to keep it a bit musical now because it's time to review the best and sometimes the worst in the world of television, cinema, theatre, books, and many more things besides. And because it's Tuesday, it's time once again for our weekly music review. And this week, well, Monocle's Paul Noble is joined by Nick Luscombe, who's a DJ, curator, and head of Musicity, for an end-of-summer musical roundup.
It's a soggy afternoon here in London, and I'm joined once again by Nick Luscombe, our music expert and resident DJ.
Hello, Paul.
Hi, Nick. How's your summer been so far?
It's been good, actually. I've been getting out and about a little bit, which is nice.
You've had some, what looks like some quite tasty DJ gigs.
Yeah, actually the one I loved was playing in the Daikanyama Tsutaya bookshop, of all places.
Yeah, which we love. There's a fantastic room there, isn't there, on the first floor?
Brilliant, brilliant space. Yeah, it's full of all kinds of amazing records as well. It's beautiful. But I had a great gig in there with this laser turntable, which is quite awesome. This huge like CD player, but you put vinyl in it instead of CDs.
So no needle, so it just reads the record.
Just runs off a laser. That's kind of mad.
How did it sound?
It sounded very, very good. I think I can't remember how expensive these things are, but incredibly expensive. So it sounded like it was, expensive.
That is very much the Sutile, no compromise way, isn't it?
Totally, yeah.
So let's work through some of your tracks which you've brought in. This is from your new show, which is going to be launching on Monocle shortly, Monocle 24 Presents. First track is Wild Birds and Peace Drums.
Yeah, so this is their first single for quite a while. They're from Sweden, and I think it's incredible, real good fusion of styles, and it's called The Offbeat from their brand new album.
A head nodder and a toe tapper.
Yeah, definitely. And when those drums kick in, they really kick in, don't they? It's amazing.
Yeah. And the album's called Rhythm, quite appropriately.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously a bit of a new direction for them, but a really great one.
Yeah, because they were a lot mellower, weren't they?
Yeah.
Like more folky guitars.
Absolutely. A little bit weird, which is also good, but this is just special. I haven't heard the whole album yet, so I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, something to look forward to. Track two is from Carmen.
Yeah, so this is quite old, 1984. This one goes back a long way. It's a bit of a soul classic from Carmen, as you said, Time to Move. And it's been brought up to date a little bit by Duke Slammer, who has been in touch with me for the last 12 months, sending me all kinds of brilliant tunes. And pretty much his strike rate is really high. Pretty much everything I've got is brilliant. So, and this is the latest one. Like I said, Time to Move, Duke Slammer on the remix.
Sean's doing some amazing breakdancing moves out there in the studio. It's a shame you can't see it. Very nice, something for everyone in that track.
Yeah, definitely. It's it's very summer, like you said. It's, even though it's not very nice here today in London, certainly does sound like summer, doesn't it?
Yeah, we're going to squeak the last pips out of summer.
Yeah.
So your third track is from Norway.
Yeah, so this is a new band from Norway that I saw recently at the Oya Festival in Oslo, which is such a great weekend of music, really varied. And these were the highlights for me, seeing these guys. And the whole set was amazing. They only played for about 30 minutes. I don't think they probably got any more songs than that. But this is the new single. It's called Mundane, but I'm not sure why, as it's not. It's very good. And the whistling is anything but mundane. So yeah, have a listen to this from Lung.
Love was the hour.
good to hear a bit of quality whistling.
Well, the funny thing was, yeah, and at Oya Festival, there were like at least three artists who were quite amazing whistlers. Brian Ferry, I saw him doing some pretty awesome whistling.
Well, his work in Jealous Guy is, you know.
Yeah, that was the track.
In the whistling stuff of legend.
Amazing, yeah. So, yeah, maybe whistling is big again.
Maybe the sax solo will be back before we know it.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Okay, let's end on your fourth pick.
All right, from Iceland, Olaf Arnolds, signed to One Little Indian. And, yeah, she's someone else with a new album, her fourth album, coming out at the end of September. I think this track's incredible. This is just called Patience.
Okay, well, thanks for coming in and sharing your music with us. We will see you shortly.
Thank you.
That was Monocle's Paul Noble talking to Nick Luscombe. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, James Schneider and John Everard, who talked us through whether Russia is preparing a possible invasion of Ukraine and if the Americans are laying the groundwork for airstrikes in Syria. Today's show was produced by Phil Hahn, researched by David Pleasant and Alexandra Stenbock-Firmer, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next, after the headlines, is Section D with Tom Morris. Then at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily, another hour of news and comment. Make sure you don't miss that. The show will be back at the same time, of course, tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's time to say goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.